From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn coming to you from New York this week. The theme of today's show, media aimed at kids for better and for worse. When Joe Murray created animated shows like Rocco's Modern Life, he didn't worry much about facts. But that changed on his new PBS series that teaches kids about different cultures.
Sometimes we call our anthropologist who's on the staff our story killer, because he'll sit there in our writers' meetings and we'll go, wouldn't it be great if, you know, such and such did this? And he'll say, no, it never happens.
Then the downside of sanitizing pop songs for kids. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. If you were a hip teen in the 1990s, or maybe even just an adult with a love of edgy humor, this might sound vaguely familiar. That's the theme song to Rocco's Modern Life, sung by the B-52s. The animated series about an Australian immigrant wallaby named Rocco and his best friend Heifer, a steer who was raised by wolves, ran for 4 seasons on Nickelodeon in the mid-1990s. Joe Murray, who created Rocco, went on to make another popular animated series called Camp Lazlo for Cartoon Network, and now he has a new show on PBS Kids called Let's Go Luna. Let's Go Luna follows the adventures of 3 friends who travel the world with their parents' variety show. Luna the Moon, voiced by actress Judy Greer, tags along on their travels and helps them learn about different cultures. I recently spoke with Joe Murray about Let's Go Luna, and we started off talking about how he got his start in television with Rocco's Modern Life.
That was actually from my independent films. Linda Saminsky, who was in charge of development at Nickelodeon, contacted me after I had sent her a pencil test of one of my films and asked her if she would give me some money to finish my film. And she said, no, but I can give you a request for a series on TV. And she says, if you have any ideas, I would love to hear it. And I said, well, my stuff is too weird. It's children's television at the time was like not a place for my work. So she said, just come up with something and throw it at us and we'll see where it goes. So I came up with, I went into my sketchbooks and had these ideas for characters that I was going to do films about. And I had Rocco in there and I had the Heifer and the Big Heads. Heifer was actually a character I did for MTV. I did some ID spots.
Some interstitials, from, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and he was out of one of those and I put them all together and I pitched it and they liked it. So every step of the way, though, I was like, I'm only making money for my independent films. I'm just going to keep on because this is never going to get made. I was like totally convinced this is never going to get made. It is too weird. And if they want to give me money to do a pilot, I'll do a pilot. So I did a pilot and it tested really well and they put it on the air.
I want to talk a little bit about your sensibility and how with Rocco's Modern Life, you are doing things that audiences are getting on different levels depending on their age and sophistication. And there are little details sprinkled throughout the series, like where Heifer writes personal ads for Rocco.
Marsupial with big hairy chest, seeking female with same. Will suck the fillings out of your teeth if you let me. I am adventurous and will try anything once. Twice if you're lucky.
But Heif, that isn't anything like me.
Details. The hard part is getting the dates. Then you'll grow on each other.
And what network is this on? This is not Adult Swim. This would be Nickelodeon.
Where'd you find that clip? I have no recollection of that clip.
When you were thinking about Let's Go Luna, which is going to be very different, what were the things you took away from Rocco's Modern Life that you could incorporate as a storyteller into a series that's going to aim at a younger audience?
story in animation is story, and it doesn't matter what age group you're aiming it at as far as the actual structures that you're using. You can make sure that it's simplified enough, but, you know, as far as making the elements appropriate, that's easy to do. You're going to find that the audience is always more intelligent than other people think, kids especially. They know a good story, and all of that is all developed over time for me, so that was able to be brought in. Also, I'm very visual with my animation, and that appeals to kids, and I was able to put that into this show. And it was just a matter of creating something that I was fine for my own kids to watch, because I'm pretty picky.
You've got four, is that right?
I've got four kids, but two of them are college age, and two of them are 5 and 2.
Well,
two boys.
As long as the college kids still love some younger humor.
But I didn't let my girls, when they were younger, I didn't let them watch Rocco until they got older.
What was your initial pitch for Let's Go Luna, and did it evolve as you started putting the show together?
I had a conversation with Linda Siminski, who's now at PBS, who was also the one who brought me in for Rocco, so her and I have a long history. And I decided this point in my career, I wanted to try something with PBS, and Linda had been talking to me about it for a while, and we were like, let's explore this. So they have certain curriculums that they like to hit with their show, and she named off a few that were missing from PBS's curriculum list, and social studies curriculum was one of them. And she goes, you know, like culture and travel. And I go, oh man, that is where I'm at. That's what I want to do. I just want to learn about other cultures, because I do that naturally. And I'm all over. I've got enough books and documentaries about other cultures to stack up. So I was like, I want to do that. And so I went back to the drawing board and I came up with these characters. So I had three characters who were traveling around the world with their parents, working at a Cirque du Soleil type performance troupe circus. And I thought, you know, for kids to be able to wander around a new city, they're going to have to have somebody that they can feel safe with. Somebody that knows the languages, that knows them, knows everybody else, you know, and that is a level of comfort. And I had written a book before, a children's book. I had done a few children's books, and one was about the moon coming to dinner. It was called Who Asked the Moon to Dinner, who ends up being a really rude dinner guest. So I'd already had some feelings of personifying the moon. And so I thought, what if the moon came down every day and hung out with the kids? So I started playing around with that idea, and then I pitched that.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Joe Murray about Let's Go Luna.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star Is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. Joe Morgenstern of The Wall Street Journal says it's fresh from thunderous start to exquisite finish, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. For consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Now let's get back to my conversation with Joe Murray, the creator of the PBS Kids series, Let's Go Luna. Luna the Moon is voiced by the actress Judy Greer. In this scene from the Mexico City episode, she talks with Carmen, who's afraid of all the skeletons she's seen around the city for the Day of the Dead.
What do you do when you're just too afraid?
Sometimes the best thing to do is just laugh it off.
Laugh? What do you mean?
That's right, laugh. And today's the perfect day to do it and overcome your fears. On the Day of the Dead, we laugh at things that would normally scare us and make it fun.
I asked Murray what made Judy Greer the right pick for the voice of Luna.
Judy had this aspect of her that was very friendly. Like, you wanted to know her, and that's really what I was looking for. And she has a big sister aspect to her voice that was really inviting, and she's just as nice as Luna comes off being. So I think, you know, like I was saying earlier, the comfort aspect of what I wanted the kids to feel when they're in another city that's different to them, that's what I wanted to have come across in the voice. And I feel like Judy really, really did that.
One of the things that's very obvious is there is a lot of research, a lot of attention to detail, even in shop windows, that you are very careful to make sure things are spelled right, things are explained right, things are pronounced right, that there is really a lot of care to make sure that no one can challenge you on these facts and that kids are going to come away actually learning something that is accurate.
Yes, and this is one aspect that is definitely different from anything I've ever done, is the accuracy.
You can't make it up here.
No. You can make up the stories, but the stories also have to be accurate. And everything you do within the story is accurate. Sometimes we call our anthropologist who's on the staff our story killer, because he'll sit there in our writers' meetings and we'll go, wouldn't it be great if, you know, such and such did this? And he'll say, no, it never happens. That's a myth. This is like the typical thing. We'll go to a city and we'll go, well, this city's known for this or this or that. No, that's actually a myth. It never happened. You know, we can't be, you know, exploiting that, because it's not true. So yeah, we do a lot of research. And the thing is that everybody on the staff does research. The storyboard people, if they put in some new prop or some new character or some, we have to be accurate with it. They have to do research too. The writers have to do research. And then when it goes into our Canadian animation studio, they do research when they do backgrounds and the sound guy. I'm just right now working on the sound of an India episode that has Rhesus monkeys, and he said, I don't think these are the way the Rhesus monkeys sound. So he has to go back in and try and find what a Rhesus monkey sounds like.
I want to play a clip from an episode where the kids ride a boat on the Nile River in Egypt.
The Nile River is so fun!
I think so too, Andy. The Nile River has always been so important to Egypt. Cairo wouldn't be what it is today without this very long river. Some people even say it's the longest river in the world. Some people like me.
The other thing that really struck me about this series, and I suspect it's taken a couple years to bring it to the air, is that the way that our country sees other cultures has shifted. And I think right now there's a lot of fear of other cultures, and I wonder if you think that the timing for your series is maybe providential, if not a little bit unfortunate.
I think that even though America is a nation of immigrants, there's always been a bit of an isolationist kind of feeling for America. And I don't think that this point in our history is any different from many other points, except there are people who propagate that kind of thinking more than others. It's total serendipitous that it occurs at a time when it really is needed. And, you know, I developed it way before, you know, anything started accumulating that on that point. So yeah, I do find that the research that we did into our American audience is that a lot of these kids don't know anything beyond the end of their block or even where their grandmother, except for where their grandmother lives. You know, they really don't have that in their everyday lives. And, you know, I don't think we have over high expectations as to far as how much of this information will be retained depending on the age group. But if I can put across that there are other cultures around the world that they don't know about, that's the only thing I would like to do. If they come away with that and they say, you know what, there are people that are different, but they're the same as me. And that's really what I want to do.
Joe, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Let's Go Luna airs on PBS Kids. It's also available on the PBS Kids app and online.
Yo. I've been moving, come no start, no trouble with me. Trying to keep it peaceful is a struggle for me.
Now let's turn to the song that you're hearing now. You may recognize it. It's God's Plan by Drake, only that's not Drake singing it, and it's also not Drake's original lyrics. It's a group of young singers called the Kidz Bop Kids. If you're a parent or even a millennial, you probably know Kidz Bop. It's the album series in which children sing top 40 songs, and since it launched in 2001, Kidz Bop has amassed 22 top 10 albums on the Billboard charts. Sure, Kidz Bop renditions of Drake and Cardi B are a bit annoying, but can the practice of having kids perform sanitized songs that originally had mature themes also be problematic? We asked a children's media expert to weigh in. Christopher Bell is a professor of media studies at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs.
Popular culture doesn't just show us who we are, it also very prescriptively tells us who we're supposed to be. And that has a very profound impact on the way we see the world. Every piece of popular culture you consume is telling you something about yourself, about the world, and about your place in it. And more importantly, it shapes the way that we treat other people.
And that, sadly, brings us to Kidz Bop. If you haven't heard of Kidz Bop, these albums are crazily successful. They have had more top 10 albums on the Billboard's Top 200 chart than Madonna or Elton John. So people who don't know about Kidz Bop, what is the general conceit? And then we'll get into some of the underlying problems.
Sure. So the general conceit of Kidz Bop, you might sort of consider it to be inexplicably enduring. One of the biggest central conceits of this is that they take popular music and then they re-record them with children singing those songs, oftentimes sanitizing and changing the lyrics to those songs in order to then market those songs directly to children.
So let's look at that conceit with one song. There's a Cardi B song called I Like It. We're going to hear Cardi B's version. Then we're going to hear the Kidz Bop version of the same song.
I like sexes from my exes when they want a second chance. I like proving wrong. I do what they say I can. They call me Cardi, Cardi, banging body, spicy mommy, hot tamale, hotter than a Somali. Virgo, Ferrari. I like texts from my exes when they want a second chance. I like proving others wrong. I do what they say I can. They call us Kidz Bop, banging party, spicy music, hot tamale, hotter than a Somali. Virgo, Ferrari. Hop on the stoop, jump in the
coop. So some of the words have been changed. I would argue, and I suspect you would too, the message really hasn't.
No, of course it hasn't. Because the message is not necessarily in the individual words. It's in the words in connection to each other. You change a couple of words, it doesn't change the message of the song at all. They've done several Cardi B songs, as a matter of fact. They also did Finesse, which is another thing that should not happen. They've done everyone from Bruno Mars all the way through Kanye West. There's a DJ Khaled cover of I'm the One. Katy Perry's California Girls, where she sings about, you know, Daisy Dukes and bikinis on top and, you know, we're so hot we'll melt your popsicle, which I don't need 8-year-olds screaming at me. There's a lot of problematic elements to the songs that just changing a couple of lyrics doesn't change the internal content of those songs.
I'm not going to ask you to violate your NDA or non-disclosure agreement, but you've done some consulting with some Hollywood companies, including Pixar. What are the kinds of things that you want to make sure that content creators are paying attention to? What are the most important topics on your list?
Number one on my list for any media content creator that I am working with is an understanding that once that cultural product leaves your walls, you lose control over the meaning of that cultural product. It's not the author who gets to decide what a thing means. It's the audience member who consumes that thing who gets to decide what it means. And so you need to be very cognizant not only of the message you think you're giving with a piece of media you create, but also the ways in which that could be seen in other oppositional ways that are still valid.
I know a place.
Coming up, Christopher Bell explains the phenomena of kids getting older, younger. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Now let's get back to my conversation with children's media expert Christopher Bell. We were talking about censorship in children's media, using as an example Kidz Bop, the series in which children sing top 40 songs, often with very sanitized versions of the original lyrics. We pick up now with a discussion of the song In My Blood by Shawn Mendes. It deals with mental health. First, we hear the original version, followed by the Kidz Bop rendition.
Laying on the bathroom floor, feeling nothing. I'm overwhelmed and insecure. Give me something I could take to ease my mind slowly. Just have a drink and you'll feel better. Just take her home and you'll feel better. Keep telling me that it gets better.
Laying on my bedroom floor, feeling nothing. I'm overwhelmed and insecure. Give me something I could say to ease my mind slowly. Just have a think and you'll feel better. Just take her home and you'll feel better. Keep telling me that it gets better.
I mean, there's a ridiculous change here. The bathroom floor becomes the bedroom floor. But I want to step back and talk about this whole idea of how this represents a view of children as not sophisticated that maybe is dangerous.
It's incredibly banal. And that's an actual good example, that Shawn Mendes song. Because here's the thing. I'm a parent. You're a parent. My daughter is 12 years old. If I want my 12-year-old to be able to listen to the song In My Blood, I want her to listen to the Shawn Mendes version of In My Blood, not to some bootleg 8-year-old singing In My Blood, because no 8-year-old is going to sing that song better than Shawn Mendes, because Shawn Mendes sings his ass off. So there's an aesthetic component to this as well that can't be overlooked, is that for me, it's not just that they aren't dealing with the content, but it's also so banal because it's also bastardizing the music itself. So there's a double component to it that I think is really traumatic.
There's this term that is bandied about sometimes in academic circles, kids getting older, younger, or is it pronounced kagoy or kagoy? What does that
K-goy.
Mean? Kagoy. Kagoy. What does it mean and why is it an important thing to talk about?
It's an important thing to talk about because we live in a consumerist society. This is one thing that I push my students to understand every day. You have been socially conditioned to believe you live in a capitalist society, and you don't. Capitalist societies are about possession. They're about having. They're about acquisition. A consumer society is not about having. A consumer society is about wanting, which is different. Kids getting older, younger matters because at earlier and earlier and earlier ages, we are socially conditioning our children to become consumers. Consumers of goods and services that have traditionally been reserved for adults. So on the girl side of things, kids getting older, younger manifests in things like over the summer, I went to a variety of clothing stores to buy my 12-year-old child shorts and realized they don't make shorts for girls that go past the middle of their thigh. That's a sexualization issue. That's kids getting older, younger.
But you're talking about something that is not limited to clothing. It is something that is
no.
a huge part of popular culture, and that is girls need to be sexualized to become women, and boys need to be dominant to become men.
Absolutely. We are a warlike people in this culture. We like war. And so one of the things that we do as a culture is we both sanitize and normalize horrific kinds of violence and then turn around and try to remove or suppress or erase sexuality. Violence is never problematic for us as a culture because we are a male-dominated culture, and male power is never going to be delegitimized. And at the end of the day, that power manifests itself in violence.
So I have a 14-year-old son, and he loves to listen to hip-hop, and some of the lyrics that he's listening to are really terrible. And because he's got his Alexa, there's no censorship. He can listen to whatever he wants to. So what are parents supposed to say to kids as they're listening to lyrics that are misogynistic? Where does a parent's role change? What are we supposed to do? Because there's so much content out there, and it's really hard to live in a false Kidz Bop clean world.
What you have to do as a parent is you have to meet your child where they are. It's not saying my kid listens to rap music and I personally think rap music sucks, so I'm not listening to what they're listening to, and then being mad that they can't make aesthetic choices within that genre. Because there are rappers that are amazing and talking about really important things. Your kid could be listening to Lupe Fiasco. Your kid could be listening to Childish Gambino. There are people talking about real things within that genre, but we don't actively engage our kids. You know, my daughter watches a lot of television because we're a television household. I do this for a living. We tend to watch a lot of television. So I tell her, watch whatever you want, but I'm going to watch it too. And then when we're done, we're going to talk about it. That very simple action means the entire difference between your child having not only access, but having cultural value attachment to things that are not okay for them, and having a child who is media literate, media savvy, and can tell the difference between things that are aesthetically good and bad.
Christopher Bell is a professor of media studies at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Havana, oh, nah, nah. You can't walk up, what the hell you doing? Hey.